Thanks so much, yeah, for inviting me and putting together this whole week. I'm really sad that I couldn't be there in person, but sadly, as a South African, yeah, visa issues are always always very time consuming. So yeah, hopefully next time I can come over. But yeah, so you know, like John said, I have a postdoc over at QSoft, which is basically this institution that focuses on like theoretical computer science here in the Netherlands, and how quantum computing fits into this picture. So something I'm like personally interested in is this idea of learning theory and what it means to inject quantum computing into learning, into this learning theory framework. So I want to tell you a little bit about, you know, what this means, my take on it. It is quite subjective. I think this is what makes it nice. And yes, I would also like love it if there were questions in between at any point in time. You know, I'm happy to address this. So I will try to give like high-level overviews of things, and if you're interested in details, then you know, let's talk about it. Okay, good. And before I start, sorry, I can just kind of hear an echo of myself, but it's not too bad. But I was just wondering why this is happening. So okay, but it's not very disruptive, so it's all right, cool. So yes, let's go to this motivation and also, you know, what it means or what I mean when I talk about learning quantum objects. So first of all, let's talk about classical learning and what this idea of even learning means, right? So what does it mean to learn something, and specifically to learn something approximately? So when I talk about learning, what I mean is approximating some function or object that you're interested in, right? And in particular, if you make an assumption that there is some true relationship, some true mapping, some true function, which let's call it F, exists, then we want to produce some other type of mapping, some other type of object or function that is close to F in some meaningful way, right? So the distance that you know, this output, this thing that we generate, is from this true object that we want to approximate. This should be some in some sense small. The distance should be small. And what distance means and all these kinds of things we can define and make more rigorous as we go. But the idea of approximately learning something also kind of comes from the fact that we can do this by looking at samples of stuff. Okay, so in particular, if we change this like notation a little bit, and we imagine we take some samples x that come from maybe some distribution, then our function taking these inputs x and giving us an output should be relatively close to the function that we produce to approximate this true function f, right? So our h that comes from, I don't know, maybe some learning model, some algorithm, it should really be correct on data that comes from some distribution, okay? So some samples. And you know, more concretely, we typically want this statement to hold that our you know, our outputted guess or function for our true one, the difference should be small with high probability over our samples. Okay, so this like the statement should hold with high probability. Okay, so this is a rough idea of like, you know, learning something from samples. And why approximately? Well, because usually exact learning is quite hard, right? Like if you want to learn something with, you know, 100% certainty, then typically you need to see a lot of samples to be able to do this. Okay, so this is why, you know, exact learning is often hard, but maybe approximately learning something becomes a little bit easier. And it's also a very natural scenario in nature, right? Like if you think about growing up as a kid, you see things in real life, you see cats around you see images of things, and you learn from seeing samples in nature, right? So we see data and we then ourselves sort of learn structures and patterns on our own. And so in this like framework, this very broad framework of learning theory, we are most interested in things like sample and time complexity of learning. So not only do we care about how many samples, how many x's do we need to see from the distribution to come up with this h, this approximation of our true function, but we also care ideally to be able to find this h in a time that's reasonable, right? So not only should it be like a reasonable number of samples to come up with this approximation and the statement that holds in with high probability, but we should be able to also find and identify this h quickly. That would be great. And really quantifying things in terms of sample and time complexity. So how many samples do we need to take? How long do we need to take to come up with this approximation? This gives us a very, very clear meaning to how hard things are to learn, right? Because if we need a ton of time, to learn something, and this is, you know, provable, then we know that that a task is, you know, going to be hard. And conversely, if we don't, then we can sort of see what's easy and what's hard to learn. And if we know this in terms of sample complexity, time complexity, it also informs us about how we can make things algorithmic, right? So if something, if we need to take exponentially many samples to learn a function, then we have no hope to learn it time efficiently as well, right? Because just sampling takes exponential time. So these are things that usually go hand in hand, sample and time complexity, and they inform us about how to build algorithms well. Okay, and so in classical literature and computer science literature, there are really, in my opinion, two frameworks that have dominated the literature, and that is this idea of PAC learning and agnostic learning. And so PAC, by the way, it's, if you've never heard of it, stands for probably approximately correctly learning. Don't let the name fool you. It is a very rigorous theoretical framework. And the two are quite, they differ quite subtly. So we won't go too much into the details. I'll just give you like the high level idea and the ingredients, and then we'll talk about how to think about this on the quantum side. Okay, good. And hopefully I can convince you that these things are actually quite cool and quite interesting. In fact, the motivation for PAC and agnostic learning really came from the fact that there was not a lot of rigor behind machine learning. And we know like machine learning models work super, super well in practice, but why, right? Like where is the theoretical justification? And PAC learning came about really to add some rigor to classical machine learning. So this is quite nice. Okay, so what are these frameworks and how do they work? They kind of just have, the way I like to think of them is there's like four ingredients here that's important in these learning frameworks. So the first one we kind of already talked about is samples, right? So there is usually a notion of data. And so like we, you know, we call this data like maybe X that comes from some distribution D. And for most classical literature where things are rigorous, usually we think of like X as bit strings, for example, like bit strings of length N, let's say. Then there is a notion of a target object, which we also kind of talked about, which is, you know, typically like a function. And in classical literature, the most well-studied functions arguably are like, for example, Boolean functions, right? So let's say F takes in some N bit string and then spits out, you know, some Boolean output. And then the other two ingredients are a notion of something called a concept class, which is basically making the assumption that the unknown function that you want to learn comes from some set of functions or some family of functions C, right? So you can really think of C as like a set of different functions and your promise that F comes from the set. And the last thing, of course, is like you want to have a model or an algorithm or a learner, all these things are kind of synonyms for each other, that outputs some H, which is usually called like a hypothesis or a guess for F. And H also comes from some set of functions, right? So H doesn't necessarily have to be equal to C, like where your function is promised to come from, but it could, right? So if it is, then this is something called total learning, proper learning, sorry. And if it's not, or if it's just like, you know, some general hypothesis class or any class of functions, then this is actually the subtle difference between PAC and agnostic learning. So agnostic learning doesn't make any assumption about the target function you want to learn. It does not say it promised to come from a specific concept class. In fact, it makes no assumption at all. So you're kind of just modeling data with some class of models, which I think in the machine learning community, this is what most people do, right? They get data from some experiment or something in, you know, out there in the wild, and then they throw a neural network onto it and then model the data like that with neural networks as these models. So yeah, so this is like at a high level, the ingredients of PAC and agnostic learning. There's samples, there's, you know, something you want to learn. You can make an assumption about the thing you want to learn, and then you model it with some algorithm. Okay, so the goal, and I promise that we'll get to quantum quite soon, and then you'll see that if you think things are hand-wavy right now, you'll probably get even more crossed with how hand-wavy things get on the quantum side. But okay, so the goal here is like an algorithm must output a function, a hypothesis function, that is close to a target function. Okay, so if we sort of write a little bit this closeness statement a little bit differently, what we're saying is like, okay, if we take some samples that come from a distribution, then the probability that our true function and our like guess, our hypothesis function, the probability that they are not equal should be very small. Okay, so the probability that these two things differ should be quite small because we want them to be the same. We want them to be close. And the statement should hold with, you know, yes, with high probability. Okay, and so what are we given access to? We're given access typically to samples that look of this form. So if x is like our bit strings, then f of x is our output, right? It takes in a bit string and then it outputs a Boolean, let's say a Boolean output, like minus one plus one. And we're given access to many of these samples. And, you know, these f of x's are sometimes called labels. And the idea here is to try and understand, okay, how can we, how many samples m do we need to take to be able to produce such a statement with you know, with such a guarantee? And if, let's say things are sample efficient, then how much time do we then need to also like find a particular age such that this statement holds? Okay. So, you know, this is not new. This is an age-old sort of theory. So like there are tons of results in classical literature about this pack learning stuff. And for example, if you assume that your function, your target function is a Boolean function, then it is already known that the number of samples you need to take to generate such a statement already scales exponentially in the input size. So if x is an n-bit n-bit string, then you need to take at least an exponential number in the input size n, number of samples to be able to produce such a statement, to be able to produce a hypothesis that is sort of close to your true function that you want to learn. So these bounds are known in sample complexity. And like I said earlier, if you are already taking exponentially many samples, then you know you can't hope for a good time complexity, right? Because you would take like exponential time just to generate the samples. So this is pretty bad. Well, you know, depending on what your goal is, this is not great. It doesn't make Boolean functions easy to learn in general. And just as a side note, quite interestingly, so two authors actually, you know, Srinivasan Arunachalam was here when he did this work with Ronald DeWolf. They showed that like, even if you take, for example, a superposition over all these samples that you can get classically, these pairs of like xi, f of xi, so bit string and then label of the bit string, if you have access to a superposition over these samples, even that does not help you gain any advantage in this sort of idea of trying to learn a Boolean function f. So the sample complexity is still exponential in n, like the size of the input, the n-bit string. So that's I guess, quite disappointing, but also quite interesting in that like this access model does not really help you. Okay, but so far, everything I've told you about this framework has been with the mindset of f being the thing you want to learn being an innately classical object, right? Like a Boolean function. And so what I want to tell you about today is like, well, what if it isn't, right? What if we try and extend this idea of pack and agnostic learning to target objects that are not necessarily classical, like Boolean functions, but are innately quantum? And so like the first natural, you know, sort of extension is like, okay, what if we take our target object to be an unknown state, right? So this is the thing we want to learn now. And again, this is not anything new, right? Like, for example, like if we assume we have access to, let's say, copies of the state, then we have like a lot of literature that already tries to produce an approximation for rho. And we'll talk a little bit about that just now. Okay, so these, you know, this idea of extending pack and agnostic learning frameworks to quantum is really like, I guess, a bit flexible. So if we have target objects that are unknown states and we're given access to unknown samples, this could be one way to formulate it. We could also make some assumptions on the concept class, right? So now rho is our thing that we want to learn. We could also restrict where it comes from. We could say maybe it's a set of, you know, maybe it belongs to the set of all possible quantum states, or maybe it belongs to a finite set of quantum states with some specific structure or meaning for us. And quite similarly, we can also like make some assumptions on how we model this approximation, right? So let's say sigma is our approximation for rho. We could also make some assumptions on how we derive this approximation. And the model and the algorithm that we would now design in this quantum setting to find such a sigma, interestingly now can combine classical and quantum compute, right? So this is like a little bit different as well. So at the end of the day, we will still care about the same things, sample and time complexity, but I just want to like sort of introduce you now to, you know, what happens when we change the target object to something quantum. So as a warm-up, let's talk about this idea of learning states, right? And the canonical example is, okay, what if you want to learn an explicit description of a density matrix of an unknown quantum state? So, you know, this is basically doing full state tomography, right? This is exactly the same thing where, you know, we're usually given copies, you know, we talk about copies of an unknown state, and in our path learning setting, these are samples, right? So we're given access to samples. And what we want to do is we want to output some hypothesis or some, you know, some guess sigma, such that our guess is essentially close to our unknown state with respect to some distance measure, which we usually, in the case of tomography, use the trace distance. So we say like this trace distance between our unknown state and the state that we produce as an approximation should be quite small, right? Okay, so we know already, again, like, thankfully we have sample complexity results that tell us how many samples of rho we need to take, how large is this like little n, how many times do we need to measure to be able to come up with a sigma that satisfies this approximation in trace distance, right? And it scales something like 2^2n. So again, it's exponential in the system size, in the input size. So rho is an n qubit state, then the scaling of the number of samples is going to scale sort of exponentially in the number of qubits. Okay, so that's also a bit sad because again, like, you know, sample complexity is exponential and so time will be as well to come up with an approximation for rho. Okay, but interestingly, there are a ton of ways to sidestep this like exponential sample complexity requirement if we just tweak a little bit the learning task. So the task of full state tomography, you know, of course, quite obviously is going to be bad. If we want to create an estimate for a density matrix, which is, you know, exponential in n, then it seems to, you know, logically make sense that we will need exponentially many samples or copies to do this. But by changing the learning task just slightly in the way we define and think things and changing what it is we want to learn, we can actually reduce the sample complexity quite a lot. And in some instances, we can also find time efficient algorithms to solve these problems. So this is the thing I want to sort of chat a little bit about. Okay. So the first sort of tweak or restriction we can make is like where rho comes from, right? So if rho comes from the set of all possible quantum states, then yeah, the task is going to be quite hard. But if we are promised, for example, that, okay, we're given samples of some unknown state, but we are promised, let's say, that it's a state of a specific type. Like, let's say, for example, we're promised that it's a stabilizer state. So in other words, we're promised that rho comes from some set, let's call it S, and these sigmas here are just basically, you know, all possible stabilizer states. So if we have this promise, then there are, I think, you know, this is not the only paper that does something interesting. I just think their methods are quite cool. There are methods for basically showing that if you're promised that your state is a stabilizer, then you can learn it in a number of samples and time that's efficient in the system size, right? So you go from exponential sample complexity, exponential time, to just something like n squared time or something, n cubed time or something like this. So this is quite cool, right? So just by promising that your state comes from a specific class, then you can learn it efficiently in samples and time. And just very quickly, how this works is like in this particular paper that I referenced here by Rochetto, they assume like access to a certain type of measurement that you can perform. And these measurements, which they call E, are basically like Pauli measurements, right? So you have identity plus some P, and P is like a Pauli operator acting on n qubits. And so if you can sort of measure these operators, you can get enough information out because of the structure of stabilizer states. You can get enough information about basically the generators of the stabilizer group of the state that you're trying to learn. So with enough samples, you can sort of use clever classical post-processing techniques like Gaussian elimination to find enough independent generators to basically explicitly construct your unknown state. Okay, so hand wavy, I know, but like it, what's cool, I think, is that really something that, you know, at face value appears difficult, if you have access to the right type of data, like the right type of measurement data, then the task actually becomes super easy in samples and in time, which is quite cool. Okay. All right. So this is like, you know, an example of like where things can potentially become easy, but there are others, right? So for example, now, what if you don't make any restrictions on your unknown state row, but you are restricted in how you can approximate it? So your model can only spit out approximations of a certain type. Okay, so these sigmas that you generate from your learning algorithm, maybe they have to be of a certain form. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. So if you're given samples now of rho, which is a completely unknown state, and you're given access to a set of known states, so let's call this set of known states S. Okay, and yeah, and in them are these known states to you, sigma I. Okay, so the task is then output a specific sigma that comes from your set of known states, such that the sigma j that you like you spit out from your learning algorithm is roughly the closest you can get by scanning through all sigmas in your set. Okay, and again, we can use trace distance, for example. So let's digest this a little bit. So this is saying I want to produce something that's close to sigma, that's close to my unknown state, okay? But it's maybe not the closest I can get with my set, but it's, you know, roughly good enough or closest to the best I can get by looking at this set of states. So why would this be important in practice? Well, sometimes I guess like, you know, you're given copies of, you know, there's some experiment running in the lab or some unknown process or unknown state, and maybe you want to be able to approximate it with, for example, something you can store efficiently classically. So again, we can use, let's say, for example, the set of all possible stabilizer states. So we know stabilizer states are efficient to store on a classical computer, right? They only cost us n squared bits roughly. And so if we have something that's super expensive running in the lab, but we know what its closest stabilizer is, we can use the closest stabilizer to try and understand properties of this unknown state. This is like a high level motivation. So if I have something super expensive that I can approximate it with something very cheap, then, you know, I can do all kinds of things with that. Okay, so if we like imagine that we have the set of stabilizers available to us to approximate an unknown state row, there's actually an upper bound on the number of possible stabilizers that there can be. There are like 2^n² of them, so still quite a lot. There's exponentially many. But there exists really, really cool protocols, one in particular called classical shadows, that tells us, even though there are exponentially many possible stabilizer states, we can actually estimate the fidelity, information theoretically efficiently, with respect to all of these stabilizer states. So what does that mean? It means the number of times we have to sample n, or the number of the number of times we have to sample from our unknown state, scales only polynomially in the system size, right? So this is something quite amazing, because what it's saying to us is that I only need to perform n² measurements on my unknown state row to be able to estimate the trace distance with respect to every possible stabilizer state. And there are exponentially many of them. So you can already get enough information out of your unknown state with just n² measurements to estimate the trace distance or the fidelity with respect to exponentially many stabilizer states. So this is quite cool. But the problem is that you still need to estimate all these trace distances, right? You still need to compute fidelities with respect to exponentially many stabilizer states. And so in the worst case, the time complexity is still going to be exponential, because even though number of measurements that you need to perform is efficient, as shown by this classical shadows protocol, you still have to scan through all of these fidelities or all of these trace distances and show like, okay, which one is the actual closest. But interestingly, a lot of people have been looking into how to change that, right? Instead of brute force searching through a list of all fidelities or trace distances, what if there's like a clever way you can sort of navigate through this information that you get from n² measurements to find the closest stabilizer state to an unknown state row? And so there actually is an efficient proposal to do this that I think was proposed towards the end of last year by some of Scott Aronson's students that show under a promise, a special promise, that you can actually achieve this efficiency. And the promise basically is that the distance between the unknown state and the next nearest stabilizer state is less than some constant number, I think. Yeah. Okay, cool. So what have I told you so far? Well, basically, that full state tomography is expensive in samples and hence time. But by changing learning tasks a little bit, so let's say, for example, not just coming up with a very strict trace distance sort of requirement estimate, but maybe like trying to approximate an unknown state with a set of states that's available to you, you can already do much better. You can go from exponential sample complexity to polynomial. And in some cases, you can even get like time efficiency as well. Okay, and you know, so far I've talked a lot about stabilizer states, but really you can think about extending this to all kinds of different representations, right? So like, what about set of Gaussian states or match gate states? If you're given an unknown state and you want to come up with the nearest approximation using, for example, yeah, the set of match gate states, product states, Gaussian states, graph states, these are all really equally interesting questions. And you can also extend this entire theory to channels as well. So I don't want to say too much about this in the interest of time, but just like to note that everything I've said can also apply for a different object and different distance measure, right? There's nothing stopping us in saying, well, what if I have a set of channels available to me that I can actually study very well? And I have something actually running in the lab, you know, like, but it costs me a lot to run something. And so I want to understand, how many times do I have to apply this unknown channel running in the lab to be able to kind of approximate it pretty well with things that I understand, like maybe a set of unital channels. And a lot of, there's a lot open here, right, with channel learning and channel approximation. So I put, you know, reference one paper with like Mark Wilder and like a couple other people who, I think this came out fairly recently, where they talk about like sample complexity of hypothesis testing for channels. But really, there is not a lot of work done in this idea of learning channels. So this is also something like quite cool to explore. Okay, good. So we talked a bit about like target objects being states or, you know, potentially channels. But, you know, there are also other ideas here to make this kind of theory quantum. And something I just want to make mention of is this idea of not necessarily learning a state or a channel explicitly, but maybe you want to learn properties of the state that are important to you. Okay, so just as a reminder, full state tomography is the strict trace distance requirement, right? So we want to produce a sigma that's close to rho in trace distance. And another way to write about this, you can convince yourself that you can kind of rewrite trace distance like this, where you take like the max over all possible POVMs E that you can apply. And you want this, you know, this distance to not be very large between your guess and your unknown state. So these expectation values should not differ by a large amount over all possible POVM measurements E that you can make. Okay, so this is really why trace distance is so strict. Like, there should not exist an E that that this difference like deviates too much, right? And so now, like, if you're interested in properties like expectation values, maybe this max over all possible POVMs is not actually something that's practical. Maybe you're just interested in some of them, right? So you don't want to necessarily have this requirement hold for every possible POVM, but maybe just a set of POVMs, okay? So more formally, you can imagine if you're given samples and now you're given also a set of POVMs that you want to measure with your state. Now, if you want an output that basically tells you that it will be close in terms of expectation values. So the measurements that you make with respect to your unknown state should sort of be close to the measurements that you would make on your guess, right? This is a different sort of formulation. This problem is called the shadow tomography problem. And the name, of course, is because like you're kind of not learning the state row explicitly, you're sort of learning a shadow of it, right? You're learning like snapshots or expectation values of it, approximations to expectation values. So this is quite a nice, quite a nice area that's gotten a lot of recent attention in learning theory. And amazingly, you know, the complexity and the number of samples that you can sort of prove to show that you can estimate all these expectation values is something like polylogarithmic in the number of measurements you want to make, right? So this is quite nice. So you really get like a log scaling in capital M, and capital M is how many measurement operators you want to be able to be correct on. Okay, good. But the time, unfortunately, at the moment for all of these sort of shadow tomography protocols in general scales exponentially in the system size. And this is something that's unavoidable, right? Because if you think about what's happening here, you're outputting usually an estimate for a state, you're outputting a sigma density matrix, which is going to be exponential in the system size. Okay. But there are ways, again, around this. So for one example is, again, using this idea of classical shadows that was introduced not so long ago, is if you restrict now your set of observables to not be any possible, you know, any possible POVME, but maybe they are, for example, local Pauli operators, then you can actually come up with sample and time efficient schemes to estimate, like to come up with an estimate that's close to all these expectation values, which is quite nice. Okay. So now I've talked about, you know, like this target object being potentially an expectation value. And there are a ton of open questions here. In fact, just today, there was a really nice, there were two papers actually that came out exploring this question about if these are Pauli observables that are perhaps not local, how can we address this question of estimating these expectation values efficiently? And so this paper that I sort of just put a snapshot in here kind of talk about triply efficient shadow tomography, which is defined as like time efficiency, sample efficiency, and also like not measuring on too many copies of your state at a time. So this is quite a cool result. Okay, good. So I don't have too much time left, so I want to spend maybe the last couple of minutes just summarizing what I've said. So I know I also talked rather quickly and probably introduced a whole bunch of epsilons and deltas in a hand-wavy way. So if there's any questions, I'm happy to discuss it further. But what I wanted to deliver today at a higher level is just the fact that there's not much sort of defined very clearly in this land of quantum learning theory, right? So in principle, you've got a lot of freedom to sort of play with the learning tasks here. And the goal is always to find efficiency for samples and time, right? So this is the hope. And if you don't, or, you know, like if you do, you find efficiency, great. You can learn something that's maybe interesting. But if you don't, this also gives you insight into hardness, right? Like hardness of problems, hardness of things that are, you know, hardness of quantum objects. And there is this nice duality of learning, right? So if you find something easy to learn, then great. You can simulate it. You can use it to understand something. But on the converse, if you find something is hard to learn, you know, it also has this like this idea or this usefulness in things like cryptography, for example, where you usually want to embed hard things, hard objects to make things difficult. So there's this nice duality. And there are many, many open questions, I guess, specifically in the shadow tomography land, where, you know, the idea is to like estimate expectation values with respect to your state. And we know that things are efficient and okay for certain class of observables, but there are many other questions and many other sort of interesting directions for other kinds of classes of observables, restricting your state and so on. And so like really like thinking about things like even changing the access to your data model changes things quite drastically. So for example, if you have only the ability to measure single copies at a time, you actually can't do shadow tomography efficiently. You have to make entangling measurements. You have to at least be able to measure two copies at a time. And this gives you like a massive amount of power as opposed to just measuring single copies at a time. And yeah, I guess like, you know, there's also a ton of stuff that's unexplored here in this idea of quantum learning theory that I'm trying to preach around here at QSOF, because I think, you know, people in algorithms and complexity trying to understand advantages of things are really sort of trying to understand what is easy and hard to learn in some sense, right? There's an idea of trying to exploit structure in problems, in data. And this is exactly what learning theory is trying to formally understand, right? And so maybe by combining these ideas that come from complexity, that come from learning theory, we can maybe try and find where true quantum advantage actually will lie. So I think that these questions and these formulations and these different learning models and different learning tasks are super nice to be able to concretely differentiate where we can learn something and where we can't. And yeah, even in terms of classical and quantum computation, where things diverge. So yes, with that, I would like to take any questions and end, I think, a little bit early, which is always good. And yes, thank you for listening. And I hope that was clear and made some sense. I happy to clarify otherwise.
Thank you very much for the very interesting talk, Amira. So we have plenty of time for questions. We start here in the room.
Hello. Thanks for the really nice talk. I just had one question about is there an epsilon dependence in the full state tomography? I just noticed there's epsilon in the other ones.
Yeah.
Is like,
I yeah, guess that's true.
Or is it just somehow like not even, you don't even need it somehow. It's independent or something.
No, I'm sorry for my terribly sloppy notation. There is definitely an epsilon dependence, and there's also like delta dependencies as well, right? So like also the probability, all these statements that I showed you hold with high probability. And so there's usually also always like a log one of a delta factor that I just kind of ignore. And yes, for full state tomography, there's an epsilon squared dependency. Yeah. And this is, I think, this is optimal. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks.
Thanks.
I have another question. If someone others,
let's somebody back there, raise it.
I was going to ask. So just to be clear about the set of like, you're talking about stabilizer states, are talking about states stabilized by polys or Cliffords or like what's, those are the states that you're kind of, that's what you mean by the stabilizer states.
Yes, exactly. So you apply a poly operator to it and it doesn't change, basically.
So does it depend on like the list of like, are you looking at the whole set there of polys or just like a subset of polys that it's stabilized by like?
Does what? So you mean, like, which example?
Like, when you say, maybe it's best to go back to the stabilizer state. Yeah, so.
This one?
When you say that the promise that it's a stabilizer state at rho, I guess there's probably something like, hidden in that notation, rho is equal to that. Like, it's not just a pure state or like.
It has to be a pure state.
And it's stabilized by like what? By like a list of polys or all of them or what's the quantifier on those?
It's exactly. So it's like you can think of it as a set of poly operators that belong to a group, which is usually denoted by the stab phi, which is the stabilizer group of this state. And it's actually, there's a very nice bijection. Like you can actually write the state, if it's a stabilizer, as a sum of these, as a weighted sum of these group elements. So this is quite nice. So there's really like a lot of structure in the stabilizer state.
Yeah, cool, thanks. I missed that line, I guess. Thanks.
No, I should have defined it actually. Yeah, sorry. That's okay.
Next question. You don't have to throw it.
Hello. So you often have to have multiple copies of whatever thing you're learning, either it be the state or the channel. And if you're wanting to learn, it's usually going to be produced by some other means that you don't have the control over, so some physical system. This may mean that in reality, each one of your rows, for example, if we were to consider states here, might not be exactly the same every single time. I'm just curious as to the algorithms that you considered, do any of them assume like any form of error on the actual states or like it coming from a distribution? And do you have any idea how that might affect the learning rate?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. And as far as I know, like all the theory kind of just assumes clean copies, right? Like as in, here, you just make this assumption that, you're given access to something sort of stochastic and you can like generate perfect copies of it. So I think if you maybe want to understand, robustness to noise in these copies, I think this is probably stuff that people have done. And for example, the shadow tomography protocol, so the one that solves this problem I put at the end, this one here. So not in this reference paper, but there's one by like Ryan O'Donnell and another author, where they produce a protocol that is robust to noise in the measurements. And I assume that this would also apply maybe to noise in the copies. So I think that this is like probably something that's not too bad. If you have reasonably well-behaved noise in your copies, I think you can handle this, but I stand to be corrected. So I think it's like a super interesting question. For me, it's definitely something I considered. I kind of just blindly sit in my room with my pen and paper and assume that one day we'll build like really amazing quantum sensors or all these words that I don't even understand, and they'll be able to generate perfect copies. But you're right, this is not so simple in practice. Yeah.
I think especially for the channels, that maybe it's like an actual physical system, it's sometimes hard to know whether or not, you know, like other things in the world would cause it to be the same every time you ran the computer. But thank you.
Mm-hmm. Totally, yeah, I agree.
Robert? Yeah, can you please give a little bit more explanation about how this learning algorithm for stabilizer states works? If you could please briefly go back to that.
Ah, yes, sure. Yes, of course.
That's great. My question is the
yes,
following.
This one.
Yeah, this one, exactly. So my question is the following. So it seems here you're measuring Pauli observables on stabilizer states. To me, this looks like a needle in the haystack. So there's 4 to the n Pauli operators, and only 2 to the n of them have a non-zero expectation value. So when you measure them randomly, you get, with overwhelming probability, a 50-50 outcome. So now you do this with, with a polynomial number of Pauli observables, you measure them, and you get 50-50 all the time. That's the likeliest event. So how can you conclude anything from that? Or how is the
yes, good question.
Different?
So, yeah. No, I think you're right. So, okay. And you know, I must disclaim, I don't know everything here too deeply, but I think in my mind how it works is like, so you're given this measurement data, right, which tells you whether P is like sort of in this stabilizer group or not. And if it is in the group, great, you've got like information to learn the state. And so like you're right, like the probability is like it's either in the group or it's not. But if you have access to enough samples, so we really should have like I from 1 to M here. So you have many samples, not just one pair. So sorry, this is maybe where the confusion comes in. Then you can just like union bound, you know, sort of all these times you're able to see a P that's in your stabilizer group. And then with high probability, you should sort of have enough information to be able to use then like Gaussian elimination techniques to find enough independent generators of the group, right? So this is like, this is roughly how I think the algorithm works, if that makes sense, yeah.
Good, I think this gives me at least a hint. Thank you very much.
Okay, the paper is very nice and short. So if you are curious, it might be worth just like peeking into it. It's, I think it's well written and it's not too long. That's always a nice combination.
Thank you.
Are there any questions from anybody on Zoom? We have time for maybe one more question. Or anybody here, for that matter. OK, well, otherwise, let's thank Amira again for an excellent talk. So thank you very much.